In the year 533, from the founding of Opet, 6 months after he'd taken the Grail Iron and claimed the four kingdoms, Lannan Hyrcanus, the head of House Barker, left the city of Opet and went out to march around his borders, a custom that would bind his claim irrevocably. He was 29 years old in that spring, a year older than his high priest. He marched with four of his wives, the childless ones, hoping to change their status upon the two-year journey. He took with him two legions, each of 6,000 hoplites, light infantry, axemen, and archers. The legions were composed mostly of wee freedmen, with officers from the noble families of Opet. These legions were organized along the Roman lines, in the manner that Hannibal had adopted during his campaign in Italy. There were 10 cohorts to a legion and 6 centuries to a cohort. They were uniformed in leather body armor with conical iron helmets and circular leather shields studded with bronze rosettes. On their legs and feet they wore leather greaves and nailed sandals, and they sang as they marched. The officers were more magnificently appointed as befitted their noble origins. Their armor was of bronze, and their cloaks were of fine linen, dyed purple and red, and they marched at the head of their divisions. There was no cavalry. In 500 years, no attempt to bring horses from the north had succeeded. Every one of the animals had succumbed to the sea voyage, or surviving, that had died soon after arrival at Opet, of a mysterious disease that made their coats stand on end and turned their eyeballs to bloody red jelly. In place of cavalry were the elephants, huge, ugly-tempered beasts who struck terror into the hearts of the enemies of Opet when they charged with the archers in the castles upon their backs, loosing a shower of arrows as they came on. In battle frenzy, however, they could wreak as much havoc among their own army as that of the enemy, and their handlers were equipped with a mallet and spike to drive into the brains of the berserk animals. Lannan took 25 of these beasts upon his march. With him went his high priest and a dozen lesser priests, engineers, physicians, armorers, cooks, slaves, and a huge flock of camp followers, merchants, prospectors, gamblers, soothsayers, liquor sellers, and prostitutes. The bullock train carrying the tentage and supplies stretched for 7 miles, while the whole unwieldy column spread out over 15 miles. This was no problem in the huge, unpeopled grass plains of the south, with their plentiful supplies of water and forage, but when Hui Ben Ammon stood on a low hill with his king and saw the slow, straggling mass coming down out of the north, he thought of the time when they would turn north again in a great circle amongst the forests and broken country along the great river. Such a collection of wealth would be a sore temptation to the pagan warbands from the unknown land beyond the river. He told Lannan his misgivings, and Lannan laughed, crinkling his pale blue eyes into the sun. "You think more like a soldier than a priest." "I am both." "Of course." Lannan dropped a hand on his shoulder. "Not for nothing, the command of the 6th Legion. Well, Hui, I have thought much of this march. In the past, it has always been a great time-waster, and a sorry expense on the treasury of Opet. My march will be different. I intend to turn a profit." Hui smiled at that magic word, the one understood by all in Opet, noble or commoner, king or priest. "I intend to make this a different type of march. In the South Kingdom we will hunt, hunts such as you have never conceived, and the meat will be smoked and dried and sold to the houses and mines to feed their slaves. We will hunt also for elephant. I would like my army to have 200 of these animals to meet the threats from the north of which you've just reminded me. I had wondered at the multitude of empty wagons that follow us." "Oh, they'll be filled before we turn northwards again," Lannan promised. "And when we pass through the gardens of Zeng, I will change the garrisons there, leaving these men in their place. Troops who stay too long in one billet grow lazy and corrupt. At Zeng, I will meet the emissaries of the Dravs from the east and renew our treaty with them. But what of the north? Huey came back to his original question. From Zeng, we will march north in battle array. The women and the others will be sent home to Opit along the road through the Middle Kingdom. We will come to the river with 2 full legions to reinforce the 2 already there, and we will cross the river on a burning and slave-taking raid that will warn the tribes beyond that a new king reigns in Opit. Lannan turned and glared towards the north, and his mane of golden and red hair and beard shone in the sunlight. For 100 years now they've plagued us, and we've been too soft to them. Each year they've grown more numerous and more daring. I will show them the iron of my hand. Sunbird, I will show them that the river is held by a barrier of bright steel, and they will press against it at their cost. Where do they come from, I wonder? And how many of them are there? Huey asked softly. They are the hosts of darkness, black because they're not of the sun god Baal as we are. They were spawned in darkness in the forests of eternal night to the north. And when you can number the greedy locusts, then you will count them also. Are you afraid, Lannan? Huey asked. And the king turned to him with a fiery anger darkening his face. You presume, priest, he snarled. Call me friend, not priest. And I do presume to show you that unreasoning hatred is based on fear. Lannan's anger faded, and he fiddled with the hilt of his sword, glancing about to make sure that his aides were out of earshot. There is reason for fear, he said at last. I know, said Huey. Huey led the praise chant to Baal in the dawn, but they kept the volume of their voices low so as not to alarm the nearest herds, and afterwards Huey asked the gods to look with favour upon the hunt, promising that a part of the spoils would be left for the sunbirds to carry on high. Then Huey and Lannan drank a bowl of wine, and ate a dry millet cake together as they waited for the hunt to develop. Mursil, the huntmaster of the south, had chosen the ground with cunning and care. From where they sat, on the low line of the escarpment, they could look down the vast funnel-shaped plain, hemmed in by hills on either hand. Along the summit of the hills, the signal fires smoked in the early morning to show that the warriors were in position there to turn any of the game that tried to cross out of the valley. In the distance, beyond the range of the eye, the 2 legions were spread out across the plain. Already they were moving forward, 10,000 men, sweeping the grassland like a wave across the beach. The dust of their advance rose palely against the eggshell blue of the morning sky, and below the pall an occasional flash of light came from helmet or spear. It's begun, said Lannan with satisfaction. Huey looked out on the tens of thousands of grazing animals scattered in herds about the plain. This was the 10th great hunt in 50 days, and the slaughter was beginning to sicken him a little. He glanced down to where the plain narrowed, and the river that bisected it ran down into the neck. At the base, squeezed into a wedge shape by the hills, was a gap of 500 paces, which promised escape to the limitless expanse of grassland beyond. The whole plain was thinly scattered with tall, flat-topped acacia trees. Even from where they sat above the gap, they could barely see the treble line of concealed pits across the gap that joined the spurs of the 2 ranges of hills. 1,000 of Lannan's archers lay in ambush there, with a bundle of 300 arrows and a spare bow. Beyond them still was a double line of netting, heavy woven mesh standing on flimsy poles that would collapse when a heavy body charged into it, smothering the animal in its folds until one of the hoplites could jump up from his hiding place and run forward with a javelin to dispatch the animal and reset the net. Here another 1,000 javelin throwers lay in waiting. We should go down now. Lannan finished the last of the wine and brushed a few crumbs from his cloak. A little longer, Hui suggested. I should like to watch this. A restlessness was running through the herds upon the plain, beginning with the animals nearest the lines of beaters. The long lines of gnu began running in aimless circles with their noses almost raking the ground, black bodies with long flowing manes kicking and frolicking. The herds of zebra grouped themselves in compact masses of some 200 or 300 animals and looked curiously towards the line of approaching beaters. Their close relatives, the quagga, short and sturdier, assembled in lesser herds, a darker bay colour than the grey zebra. Mixed with them were herds of brilliant yellow and red hartebeest, purple sassaby, and the great bovine eland, striped and maned and majestic. This vast multitude began a stirring and a moving, a general slow retreat down the valley towards the gap, and the dust rose around them. Ah, said Lannan, what a booty! There could never have been a greater in the history of the hunt, Hui agreed. How many do you think? Lannan asked. I don't know, 50? 100,000? Wouldn't be possible to count them. Now the long-necked giraffe were infected by the growing alarm. They left the shelter of the acacia trees, and their calves followed them as they joined the mass movement down the valley. Amongst the host trotted an occasional rhinoceros, big and cumbersome, horned and snorting, lifting his massive hooves high as he ran. Like a flux holding the entire mass together, moved the smoky brown herds of the dainty springbok. They came on down the valley, moving more urgently, like floodwaters, and the dust rose thicker, swirling up in choking clouds. The hills squeezed the herds into a denser mass, and when the hartebeest and sassaby tried to cross the ridges on either hand, there was a line of screaming, weapon-brandishing men to meet and turn them from the crest. They charged down the slopes again, carrying and spreading the panic through the closely packed herds below. They surged forward, and the sound of their hooves rose like the storm, surf, and wind. The ground began to shake. Come, shouted Lannan, and he jumped up and went bounding down the slope. For a moment longer, Hui watched that unbelievable phalanx of living creatures thundering down on the gap. Then he shouldered his axe and went racing down the slope after Lannan. His long black hair streamed out behind him, and he ran goat-footed, rabbit-fast, so that he and Lannan came out on the plain together. And Hui led the way into the centre of the gap, where a pit had been dug for them and a dozen bundles of javelins lay ready. Lannan jumped down beside him. There was no gold on that race, he laughed. There should have been, said Hui, and they went to the front lip of the pit and looked up the valley. It was a terrifying sight. The entire valley, from side to side, was clogged with a great tide of living things, and above them rose a high brown wall of dust through which the low sun glared balefully. The heads and manes of the lead animals tossed and heaved like the surface of a torrent, and above them rose the stick-like necks of the giraffe and ostrich. The whole bore down upon them, and the earth trembled beneath them, and they stared in awe and wonder. Lannan was judging his moment carefully, waiting for the first wave of game to cross his range markers. The moment came, and he snapped an order to his trumpeter. The single urgent note of the attack ran out, repeatedly and stridently, over and over again. From the earth at the feet of the advancing wall of living things rose the line of archers. They loosed 4 times before the wall swept over them. 4,000 arrows in 20 seconds, and those that followed fell over the wind rows of dead animals, screaming with the agony of broken bone and arrow-impaled flesh. borne by the weight of their own forward momentum, the masses of game pressed onwards while flight after flight of arrows decimated their ranks, and the corpses and wounded piled in ridges and huge mounds. The smaller game were wiped out by the archers, but the larger thick-skinned animals came through with the arrows bristling in their flanks. Great grey rhinoceros, lumbering wild-eyed towards the line of nets, tossing their long, curved nose horns. Giraffe, galloping long-legged and terror-driven. A squadron of black buffalo, running in a mass, shoulder to shoulder, like a team in span. They came into the nets, and fell struggling and screaming. The javelins whipped into them as they rolled and roared, smothered in the folds of heavy netting. Desperately, Lannan and his men worked to clear the dead from the netting and reset the poles. But it was effort wasted. There were too many of them now, and there was death out there in the open, beyond the security of the pits. Arrow-maddened, the wounded game charged for any man who showed himself. Huey saw a soldier tossed by an angry rhinoceros. He cartwheeled in the air and fell on the hard earth to be kicked and trampled to a muddy pulp in the dust by the hordes that followed. From the pit, now, Lannan hurled his javelins with an uncanny accuracy and power, aiming each bolt for the soft ribs behind the shoulder of the passing game. He piled the bodies about the pit, shouting and laughing in the frenzied excitement of the hunt. Huey also was infected by it. He danced and shouted and waved his axe, guarding Lannan's back and flank, hurling a javelin when some huge animal seemed about to crash into the pit on top of them. Both he and Lannan were soaked with their own sweat and caked with the swirling dust. A stone flung by a dashing hoof had cut Huey's forehead open to the bone of the skull, and he ripped the hem from his tunic and bound the wound quickly, hardly interrupting his dance of excitement.